best providers turn into a social enterprise. If you missed part one, I suggest you go and listen to podcast number four. Otherwise, this won't make very much sense and you won't know who's talking.
I mean, one of the interesting discussions that I'm finding a few people are having is, do they go down a staff ownership model or a staff and community ownership model? And I think there's lots of pros and cons either way. And I was just, was that a debate that particularly had, and or?
It was certainly something.
We're nodding.
That,
I don't remember that debate.
No, well,
foundation trust. I suppose at one level, you've got staff, and I'm a member of my foundation trust, which means I get a newsletter twice a year, and that's about.
Yeah, I mean, at the time we were doing our early thinking, which would have been the beginning of 2005, when we were just putting that kind of model together. The concept of a community foundation trust wasn't even discussed.
Yeah.
So that was a non-starter. So it wasn't an option available to us.
And we still don't really know if they're going to get off the movement.
We're not particularly talking
politics, but people talk about them, and I have to remind people that actually none of them have gone live yet.
They've
got to go through Monitor and all the rest of it before.
Obviously, there would have been models of company ownership. We could have gone for a company limited by guarantee or other models which might have given more community ownership in the organisation. However, because we have this specialist personal medical services contract with the PCT, that excluded that as an option because it would have invalidated us from that contract. So we were very tied in to the contractual obligations of a PMS contract.
And as you said, John Lewis seems to be working, you know, it's a good model.
But it means we need to find other ways of involving the community. If they're not doing it through a membership model or through a shareholding or being part of the company, then we do need to think about how we do that. We've got a strategy that we're just about to put through our voice for consultation with our members at the moment about with our co-owners, about thinking about what does community involvement look like, how do we seriously do this differently, because I'm quite sure that if we really ask our patients and our community what they'd like our services to look like, I don't think they'd look like they do now. I'm sure they wouldn't. Some of them would be different.
I think with the community interest companies as well, is that usually there's buildings involved, and it's those that go into the sort of pot that can't be dissolved out.
Yeah.
Whereas we don't own our buildings, the PCT have kept them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
we've tried in our Articles of Association to get as close as we can to something that looks a bit like a community interest company and looks a bit like, we do act as a not-for-profit organisation, but we've tried to mirror our articles to almost put in the kind of asset locks that are in a community interest company.
Yeah.
So we've tried to come as close as we can. Again, community interest companies weren't available when we were setting up. It was a little bit early for those as well.
I think we were so clear in our values, weren't we? When we actually articulate our values and work through those, that is what we want. You know, we want to add something additional as well as excellent healthcare provision to the community. And I think, you know, everything just has to go at a pace. And we have gone at such a pace this last year. And I think now's the time to start saying, how might we partner, which is one model, how might we invest, and what does that look like? It sounds a bit trite sometimes, but you know, we can't change everybody's world, but we can change somebody's world somewhere.
Yes.
And so I think we're trying to say, okay, was there one person, is there one partnership that wouldn't have happened had we not had those values and had not committed to our local communities?
I mean, I think when we set the company up, we wanted to make something better for patients.
Mm.
We felt we could do something more with our services, we're more in control and could be more candor and flexible. We wanted to make the services better for our commissioners so that they felt they were receiving something better as the person purchasing the services. And we wanted to make it better for our own staff, as they were then, co-owners as we call them now. And that's why we went for the co-ownership model as well, because we wanted to see benefits for all three of those, patients, commissioners and staff, not just the patients and the commissioners.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting because I was at Aradhasi's International Clinical Summit 2 or 3 weeks ago, where they were bringing best practice speakers over from various other countries. And lo and behold, what was their big kind of topic items were, yes, you've got to get kind of more flexible services to patients, but so your patients are happy, but you've got to make sure your staff are happy.
Yeah.
And there was a strong, strong agenda coming through. And I thought, yep, that's exactly
right.
What we've been trying to do.
And I think there's almost a perception, and I often challenge it, where people assume that NHS staff are really happy and staff in the private sector aren't. And you go, actually, there's good and atrocious practice in both. And in fact, particularly some of the examples I've seen, is staff morale goes up when they're outside the NHS, because sometimes people work in, you know, or when they move to a social enterprise with it in Ireland. I mean, what was, if we can talk a bit about, one of the things that I tend to get a lot of questions about is just the kind of the mechanics of the transition. So we sort of don't want to get too far into the cheapy stuff, but the kind of, obviously there's a big HR thing and people are being transferred from the NHS. What were some of the lessons from that process? I mean...
Oh gosh, yes, it was a huge process, obviously,
right.
Particularly because it was the first time that anybody had done anything like this for this number of people to this level. I think it comes down to very strong communication. I suppose one of our challenges was that because it was all so new, is that often we didn't have the answers because we were still working on them.
Yeah.
So the department was still looking into things. Whatever the question we asked was, we're not sure, we need to find out. So,
and people can then think, oh, that's a hidden agenda.
Exactly.
That happened all the time, didn't it?
Completely, that happened all the time. And it was usually us waiting for information, confirmation to come back. So consulting on something where you are in a journey and the answers aren't necessarily known is a challenge in itself. But it is just about maintaining communication. You can't over-communicate in a situation like this. I'm sure if we went back, we would say... communicate even more, but you can't.
I think one of the things we learned and did quite well was we actually started putting out that newsletter.
We did.
Yeah. And I think that we needed something tangibly written down. It wasn't just briefing through the management cascade. Mm. So we started putting out these newsletters where there'll be a top tip and this is how far we've got on pensions, this is how far we've got on the transfer. And there was information and we organised some meetings. So experts came in and actually gave information that was backed up by something written. So I think multiple ways of communicating was absolutely key, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did quite a lot of face-to-face briefings as well, didn't we? Where Joe and I would go out and just at different venues and just give a face-to-face update, questions.
And that was very valuable from a lot of the staff who didn't go to briefings for one reason or another. When you actually came out to the bases and spoke to them face-to-face, it was very valuable.
And I think we tried to share what we called then, I think we called the reference group then, because we changed the name quite a lot. We were a reference group, then an implementation group.
Yes.
But the senior kind of team of people that were working on the ideas, we tried to make sure that we went to those as well. So it wasn't just Joe and Tricia, because it was increasingly easy to think this was the Joe and Tricia show. And that's one of the ways of undermining. So we constantly went together as a wider team and made wider contacts, which was important, wasn't it?
Well, it is, because a lot of this was about empowering people, wasn't it? And that's our current journey is still about empowering people.
How do you widen that?
Yeah.
And about changing from briefings where people would say to Joe and I or to the senior team, what are you going to do about this? To thinking, what are we going to do about this? And getting that kind of ownership of it's our issues, not someone else's problem to solve.
And moving on from those, you know, I mean, certainly I've had experience, you know, what's happening with my lease car, what about my stocking allowance, and one of the things I've got, you find these weird allowances that people go, and I've had that sort of, what do you mean that? And they go, it's £5 a year for such and such. And,
We also had, you just prompted me to think of our, we had a whole question and answer sheet with frequently asked questions.
Yes,
every time somebody came up with a, what about my blah, we'd go, we'd put that on the list and on it would go. And the questions, they would get circulated so that things that were being asked most frequently, they were available to people as a regular update.
I've also found it, and it depends on whether you can do it or not, but I've also found that if your union people are reasonably sensible, if you get them alongside you and they're giving the same answers, it relaxes people. Because they go, we've done cheapy, we know how to do cheapy, you know, the process is fine kind of thing. So, I mean, were there any kind of, I don't know, weird hiccups that you weren't expecting? Because I suppose come 1st of October and, you know, were there sort of things that you sort of thought, oh, we haven't thought of that suddenly became...
That's an interesting question.
I think it's because it was quite a slow process to start with.
Okay.
Things kept coming up. And I don't think there were any big surprises coming the 1st of October.
All right. Now, I've come across, I mean, I think we talked about suppliers earlier, but it can be weird things like someone suddenly goes, oh, the name on the invoice is wrong, or payroll goes a bit funny. Or
We've probably had a few little bits, but they were quite minor. There was nothing kind of major. Little things like that where, someone's still sending the invoices to this place. Or, for example, we've come off the electronic system that the PCT was using. They still had invoices on their electronic system. There was a whole handover phase where our invoices were still going onto their system and, you know, just the whole crossover of kind of leaving one organisation. Yeah. And that just came down to regular contact, communication.
Well, so one person took responsibility for checking all of them and managing our side.
They
and then
did.
Right. So we created like an individual interface to make sure both parties got what they needed without everyone, you know, getting overly involved.
But I suppose one of the benefits about a long setup phase, and we'd also had a 3-month kind of trial period, haven't we, in shadow, running in shadow form, was that we pretty much ironed out all of those things so that there were no big surprises. Mm. No.
So one lesson, I suppose, is a good shadow period then of trying it and picking up. Sorry.
And also the expectation that one of the things we did have to manage was it was no different. Because we've been working together quite a long time. People were going, so it's no different then. And my retort to them was usually, are you different now?
Yeah.
Because actually we transferred a load of people with NHS history, values, beliefs, and rebadged them and then said, we now want you to become different, and everyone has to become different.
Yeah.
So it was very much a case of, you know, how different are you then? What are you doing differently now? What are you doing for your team, your staff? How are you thinking? That was quite funny.
But they're
still
learning
that.
Sorry.
They're still learning that.
They're still
learning.
Some
of them still haven't become different. They're still
Yet.
They're still.
But I think if you went to John Lewis and asked them that question, they would say there's always a proportion of people who don't particularly buy into it and kind of come to work and go.
But I think our individual challenge is that we took that many people, whereas the one people we're employing now, like some of the students we're employing, recently qualified nurses, they're coming into what we are.
Right.
So that's a different
branch
of staff, isn't it? Rather than transferring people from one world to another.
Well, one of the best quotes I've heard about change management, though, is that if anything's changed in the first month, it's because it's gone wrong. So you won't get any improvement in a month, but if on the first day no one gets paid or, you know, the electricity doesn't work, then that's what people tend to notice.
Mm. I think one of the great things that we have actually done is the coaching programme. And I think that's opened up conversation. So we all had a coaching, motivational sort of training. And then we've got some tools, these cards, and it opens up conversation. So if I'm not used to talking to, say, Julie would bring some cards and say, these are my values. And then it opens up a conversation about what does that mean for you in your day-to-day work and how can I help you achieve your job without compromising your values. And I think that has really enabled us to have different sorts of conversations.
Right. So how does that, is there a number of coaches or is it a coaching program? How does that work?
Yeah, well, we started because this was part of us kind of trying to bring in a bit more of a feeling of the co-ownership and trying to change the culture of the organisation, really, to think differently about how we work with each other. So all of our co-owners went through a half-day workshop called You Can Make a Difference, which is where they were thinking about what they can bring to the business and what co-ownership means for them and what they want to achieve from it. And then from that, we've got a large number of people who've been trained to have these coaching conversations. We've got the cards, and it's a toolkit, really, a motivational toolkit. And people have gone online and done a motivation survey. So we've assessed their level of motivation, what drives them. And we'll be redoing that at some point. And in between that, we go ahead with the conversations. And it is about having a different kind of conversation with somebody. It's about understanding what motivates individuals, because it's quite different. Somebody might say, I need support, or I need more support. And what one person means is, I need to see you more often. I need to be able to talk something through. I need to be able to check out that it's okay, and someone else will say, no, I don't want all that fuss over me. I want some support, but what I mean is I'm going to send you my list of actions, and if you've got a comment, just wing it back, and that's completely different. So it's about understanding individuals and what motivates individuals to get the best out of each person.
It certainly worked. We've done all the clinic coordinators, and they've all thought it's going to be the formal PDR and sort of come little bit apprehensive, and you have an hour, a cup of coffee, these cards, and you go through it exactly the same way, and they are thoroughly enjoying it. And some of the things you're actually getting out, you wouldn't have got out if we hadn't been able to use these as a toolkit. I mean, they've been really, really good. Very positive outcomes.
So could you give us some examples then of the kind of, just to make it a bit realistic?
One of them is why I value being part of a team.
Right.
I value being trusted and allowed to get on with my job. So therefore, I'm given the power to make a decision. I value being customer relations. There was one about customer relations. I value being allowed to interact with customers and things like that. And they really, they're full of it.
Well, the idea is that you choose your top three, isn't it? So you're finding out what really...
What are your key
values? Your key values.
And when you've done a whole team, like we've done, they've been asked to pick out three or four. And I would say the same five cards are coming out from all of them.
Right.
So you've got this theme where they value being trusted, respected, being allowed to get on with their role and not have too many management issues. You know, they are left to get on with it. And if they need help, they ask for it.
And they can then use that with their managers and go, here's a dialogue.
It's a joint tool.
For some individuals, they're more confident to tell their manager how they will perform best, and other people aren't. I think the tools have actually given everyone a bit of a level playing field.
Yes.
So it might be easy for me to say to Tricia, if we're going to work together, these are the things that I really need. I might not need the cards.
Yeah.
But for other groupings, it's a real challenge because they still see the hierarchical control being there. So I think for that group of staff, it's been particularly transformatory to actually come with a card and say, this is what matters to me.
Right.
And it just enables that conversation.
Right. And you combine that with the survey and the survey results, and they get their individual results. But the group's results for a team, for example, are anonymised and put together for the manager to see, so that manager gets a sense of
the values of their team.
And how their team, how motivated they are. There's different aspects of the motivation questionnaire. And it enables them to look at how they can improve their motivation, both from the manager's point of view, but also from the individual's point of view. It challenges the individual to say, well, what am I going to do about the fact that I've got quite a low score here? What is it that I'm not happy with? What am I going to do about that?
Yeah.
How can I change that, as well as waiting for someone else to change?
So are there any examples, I mean, it might be too early to say, but are there any examples of kind of things you've been able to do that you wouldn't have been able to do kind of before? Or I mean, I know we're only a year into it.
We are, but I think it's been great to see how much progress we've made, actually. At the end of our first year, we did a birthday edition of our newsletter, and we asked people to send in what they felt their teams had achieved in the first year. And pages of stuff came in, which I think, given where we've been and the struggle people were having to just keep the show on the road, is a real testament to what they've been able to do when we've said, well, look, take some control of your working life.
Okay. Are there any examples?
Plenty. I think it's been massive.
Suddenly gets that big wad of.
Some of our services had some really long waiting times. The wheelchair service, the physiotherapy service, both had, you know, some really difficult waiting times. Physiotherapy, routine physiotherapy, was up at 18, 19 weeks.
Right.
We've had that down to 4 weeks. And that's just by the team being more in control of their budget and being able to respond with their staffing in a much more flexible way. And because we're working more with the GPs and they're our customer, we're listening more to their needs and trying to respond. So we've now given them much more information about their referral rates and how they're managing their referral rates. And we interface with them much more regularly so that we can kind of manage it in a more appropriate way. And it's very successful.
And there was that new business idea for gait analysis, where we've got a senior physiotherapist and a podiatrist who now do a joint clinic analysing how people walk. And we invested some equipment into that so they could actually get camera shots and then give feedback to the individual and correct walking. And that's been really good because it was a new idea. It was brought by a co-owner. It was using available resources slightly differently and investing a small amount of money to actually make it an effective analysis and treatment. So that's a sort of example, you know, just by getting people to work together.
And I think virtually well, every team could give you a list of things that they've achieved like that, where they've just made some, sometimes small, sometimes bigger, developments and changes. And I think there are changes and developments that any NHS or any team of clinicians should be able to do. It's just that, generally speaking, it's quite hard to make the change happen. And so I think what we've been able to do is put through a lot of changes in quite a short period of time. It's not that we're doing anything that no one else could do. It's that we've got the freedom to make it happen.
And we've encouraged people to say, what is it you would like to do? Never mind you think there are restrictions. In an ideal world, what would you like to do? And then go, well, actually, that only needs a small amount of change and investment. Yes, we can do that.
And I think that's one of the things I find most exciting. So I don't think there's anything you need to be a social enterprise to do.
Mm.
But there is something where if people feel that they can make those decisions, that it's okay, that they're being encouraged to do, whereas sometimes you get, and I find a lot of cultures around the NHS where people feel they can't do it, they ask their manager and they're told no, or you know, there's no money, and there's a very negative reaction to change rather than, okay, let's come up with ideas and
I think
explore
that's
it.
Where we've been able to make significant progress.
Do.
It's the can do. We ask how can we, not no, we can't.
No, we can't.
Yeah. We just kind of say, right, how can we make that happen? Yeah. I suppose the area where I think we have made progress that other organisations might not is that because we're seen as a more can-do, flexible organisation and because we're a bit more independent, we're finding that other organisations are coming to us and saying, what can we do in partnership with you, which we didn't have before. So as an example, in this patch, our local leisure provider, the people who run the local leisure centre, happen to be a co-owned social enterprise, Greenwich Leisure.
And they've
come to us and said, okay, you know, we're in your patch, we've got a leisure centre here, we're interested in getting people fit and healthy, you are, can we do some work together?
Absolutely.
Can we think about how, and that wouldn't have happened in the past, I don't think. So that partnership focus is...
And education providers have wanted to say, how can we... You know, share our expertise in terms of learning and development with you and also get up-to-date examples of how things are changing. So that's been very, very exciting.
And it's good when you get, because funny enough, I've seen some cases on Greenwich Leisure and they were saying the same thing about the co-ownership. Once people started thinking of it as their facilities, their pool, they were coming up with all sorts of ideas and suggestions that services were getting a lot better.
The other area, I think, where... We're making more progress is because we've got this business culture and because we have to be robust in our business processes, we've had to think more about how do we measure the outcomes of what we do.
Okay.
And that's quite a challenge for community services and for nursing and therapy services, because often our added value is in something less tangible than a phone conversation or something. It's not about the number of visits, it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Particularly some services are stopping deterioration. So if you think, what's the value of...
Or quality of life.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a lovely letter from a patient who's has MS who came to us for some physiotherapy, who clearly had a lot of input in the past. And part of her thank you letter said, for the first time in my life, I think I can see how I might be able to live with my condition.
Mm.
That's something that's very powerful. So we've been doing work on metrics, which is great.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to thank you very, very much. And I tell you what, I won't give out an email address, but if people want to get in contact, because I know you get flooded, they can email me and I'll pass it on. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thanks, David. Thanks. Good to speak to you.
And that was the end of the interview, and I'd particularly like to thank the staff of Central Surrey and the directors and the team for making me feel very welcome and sharing their thoughts and views on what's worked and what hasn't. Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health, and you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's entrepreneurses.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.